Where are we in the course so far? Last time I was talking about the Near Eastern crisis of the late 1870s, the crisis that began in 1875 and climaxed in 1877, 1878. It really seemed for a while that there was a very good chance that Britain and Russia would go to war with each other. Crisis was finally settled by some agreements that were worked out, above all between the new British Foreign Secretary, Lord Salisbury, and the Russian ambassador in London, his name was Shuvalov. And those agreements provided the basis for the official settlement, which was worked out at the Congress of Berlin, Congress of all the European great powers in 1878. Right? Why were we interested in that story? Because it would shed some light on these fundamental conceptual problems that we're concerned with in this class. And above all, this question of power politics. You know, it's questions of how does a system based on power work? Right? Is that sort of system a bad thing? Is it bad to have a group of states who are concerned, above all, with power, with their position in the international political system? And related to that is this fundamental question of are there general principles that should serve as guideposts for the conduct of foreign policy? Do you want realist foreign policies, policies that are unideological, amoral, concerned above all with power considerations and not with moral considerations or ideological considerations? Very fundamental issue, not just from the standpoint of, you know, academic theorists. It's a fundamental issue for in practical politics, for the actual conduct of policy. You see it all the time. You look at, for example, at the period between the two world wars and try and understand why you know, especially the Western democracies pursued the policies they did, especially, you know, policies culminating in you know, the appeasement strategies of the 1930s. A lot of it had to do with the lessons that they drew looking back on the period before 1914. What had caused the First World War? Awful lot of people thought it was what they called the old diplomacy, power politics, diplomacy of arms and alliances. And I remember when I was first introduced to this, these issues in high school, we had a textbook that kind of had a certain section on the origins of the First World War. And it listed the basic factors that caused the First World War. The alliance system, the arms race, the old diplomacy, secret diplomacy, power politics. And then when I first began to think about these things, it occurred to me just how weak that interpretation was. It's ahistorical. It's like these lists of factors. You know, it's like a cookbook recipe. And it's like take one part the alliance system, one part the arms race, season with a dash of social Darwinism, and bake for 30 years, and then you get the First World War. It's like it doesn't come close to capturing what was going on. The logic of a historical process unfolding over time. So as I say, this is the fundamental question we're concerned with: power politics. And what is the story of the Near Eastern crisis of 75 to 78 tell us about that issue of power politics? Was power politics to blame? Right? And you look at the policies of the two main parties that were clashing there, Britain and Russia, And you could ask, is the problem due to the fact that those two countries were thinking in power political terms, or is it due to their failure to think in power political terms? So those questions, they don't give us the answers, but they frame the issue. They're like a searchlight that tell us what we want to look for when we go into the sources. And you look first at the British side, the policy pursued by Disraeli especially. The policy, contemplating a war with Russia. Rather cavalier policy of taking Britain into the war with Russia. Very similar, I should say, to what we saw with Palmerston at the time of the Crimean War. These grandiose ideas about how a war with Russia would be fought. This is Disraeli in a letter to the Queen, Queen Victoria, as this crisis was brewing. He says, in the event of war, Russia must be attacked from Asia. They underline things a lot in those days. That's underlined. Troops should be sent to the Persian Gulf, and the Empress of India, the Queen of England, should order her armies to clear Central Asia of the Muscovites and drive them into the Caspian. Very grandiose notions of war. Is this what you think of as a realist policy, as a policy that's attuned to power political realities? Well, there's an alternative. And the alternative was the policy that was championed by Lord Salisbury and was implemented by Salisbury when he became Foreign Secretary. Very different policy. This was a policy of reaching an accommodation with Russia. A policy based on the notion that Russia was a major power, Britain was a major power, and they could relate to each other on a business-like basis as one major power to another, each with their own interests. And Salisbury very clearly parted company with Disraeli about this issue. His goal was to save the peace by reaching a deal. A deal based on the notion that you had two great powers in relations with each other. And he actually gave a public speech, making fun of the whole Disraeli approach. He referred to this colonel friend of his, who had demonstrated to him, and this is a quote, that Russia was in Armenia, that Armenia is the key to Syria, that Syria is the key to Egypt, and that anyone advancing into Egypt has the key to Africa. By this list of keys long drawn out, he shows that the present victories of Russia, against Turkey that was, seriously menace South Africa. And then he says that is characteristic of the apprehensions I hear around me. It's a reference to Disraeli. And then he said, it has generally been acknowledged to be madness to go to war for an idea. But if anything is more unsatisfactory, it is to go to war against a nightmare. Okay. Very different approach. Who are the power politicians? Who are the realists? Who are the ones who are thinking in terms of power? Who are the ones who are in the great tradition of European power politics? Balance of power, equilibrium of power, limited goals, use of force only for issues of your core national interest. Very striking difference between Salisbury and Disraeli. Neither of them is a liberal, of course. But we tend to structure the problem as liberals versus realists. Not that simple. Whole story towards a British policy in the crisis throws a certain line on this. Also, the story of Russian policy, and you have the same sort of gap. Really nice, right? Nice book on Russian policy in this crisis by someone named B.H. Sumner called Russia and Balkans during this period. And what it shows is that the people who wanted to preserve the peace were the people who thought in power political terms. People like Shuvalov, the Russian ambassador in London, works out this arrangement with Salisbury so that they avoid the war. You know, cut back on these grandiose ambitions that Russia had of radical transformation of the status quo in southeastern Europe, embodied in the Treaty of San Stefano, this huge Bulgarian state and so on. You know, cutting back to what the other powers in Europe would tolerate. Well, that's in the tradition of balance of power, equilibrium of power. On the other hand, there were people who allowed themselves to get carried away with emotion, with all this talk about Russia's historic mission as the champion of the Orthodox peoples of the East, of the Slavic populations of southeastern Europe. And people who threw aside their caution when it became clear that Russia was having such a hard time defeating Turkey. When you're paying a much bigger price for a victory than you thought, then you want the prize of victory to be commensurate with the price that you paid. And so in the course of the war against Turkey, you see Russia casting off her previous restraint. You know, is that power politics? It's the same basic point. Power politicians, they respect each other's power. They reach, you know, they reach agreements based on the principle that power accommodates power. All right. What else does the story tell us? It throws a little light on the whole issue of the concert of Europe. If you don't want a system of unrestrained, purely selfish national policies, you want countries to pursue policies with an eye to what's in the interest of the system as a whole. And that notion we saw lay at the heart of what was done in the post-Napoleonic period, the whole system set up at the Congress of Vienna, Concert of Europe. And one of the great institutions created by the Concert of Europe was this whole idea that when change in the status quo was being considered, all of the European great powers should get together and agree on it jointly. Right? So you had this system of congresses and conferences where the major powers would deliberate on what had to be done. And there's this kind of quasi-legalist tradition here, that there's a public law of Europe and the public law could only be changed by common consent. And so, in fact, you had that tradition, although it had gone into decline, continuing, in fact, up to the eve of the First World War. And you see this with the very fact that the Congress of Berlin was convened. Right? Congress of Berlin, don't forget, it was not of fundamental importance. The really significant agreements that headed off the war were made prior to the convening of the conference, and these agreements especially between the Russian and British governments, between Shuvalov and Salisbury. But it was important the Congress ratified. And it's an interesting issue. Is this a good thing or a bad thing that you have this institution? Are these international institutions a source of stability or not? Well, in a sense, you could say, well, it's easier for countries to accept political defeats if they're at the hands not just of their immediate rival, but at the hands of Europe as a whole. Case. It was easier for Russia to accept the rewriting of the Treaty of San Stefano if all of Europe was basically telling Russia that this had to be done. Russia's ambitions had to be scaled back to what the other powers would accept. On the other hand, there was something destabilizing about this system too, because the quasi-legal aspect of it meant that that this machinery was being brought into action to bring pressure to bear against one country in particular. The country is kind of defined as a lawbreaker. In this case, Russia was in the dock. The finger was being pointed at Russia. You know, it wasn't just pure power politics. Russia was considered a lawbreaker. Not necessarily a good thing. Okay. Now, one last point about all this, and that is that it relates to a very important body of international relations theory called offense-defense theory. I know how many of you have heard of Robert Jervis. He wrote a very famous article, actually when he was an assistant professor here at UCLA, came out in 1979, called Cooperation Under the Security Dilemma. And it explored this notion of the security dilemma that I'm sure you've been exposed to in other classes, but I've talked about it a bit here. This idea that in a system of sovereign states where everyone's concerned with their security, and you can only increase your security by building up your power in the system. But when you do that, it's at the expense of everyone else's power. The stronger you are, the weaker other countries become. And they might actually think that the reason you're building up your power is for aggressive purposes. And this may lead them to take counteraction and so on, so you would have these security competitions that could lead to serious international conflict. The security dilemma lies, Waltz alluding to this notion in that article you read. The security dilemma could lead to conflict among states that it would be very happy to accept the status quo if everyone else was willing to accept it. Right? It's this notion you don't need aggressors to have wars. Countries can be led to behave aggressively for purely defensive purposes. And Jervis went on to consider the whole question of what determines how pernicious the security dilemma is. That was his term, pernicious. How acute the security dilemma is. And his basic argument in that article was it turned in very large measure on the sort of military technology that was in place, military strategies that were in place, in a world where the defense is dominant. You think of like the world of the First World War, where it's very hard to have successful offensive military operations. Then you don't have to worry too much about the security dilemma. Its hard edges are kind of blunted, when countries build up their power, it's very obviously for defensive purposes because that's the kind of forces you're building. The forces you have are only good for defense. Whereas if the offense is dominant, then you have to build up offensive forces even for purely defensive purposes. And it's very hard to see what your rivals are up to and so on. It's much more likely that you're going to behave like an aggressor in an offense-dominant world than in a defense-dominant world. This is the argument. And these arguments were taken up by a body of theorists, most notably Stephen Van Evere and his book Causes of War, and Jack Snyder, who's written on the subject, and applied in particular to the whole question of the origins of the First World War. Right? But this basic notion that they developed this whole argument, they're trying to support this argument with historical evidence, but the basic notion is that a defense-dominant world is a stable world. Everyone just wants to build up their defensive forces. No one has to worry about anyone else. Whereas an offense-dominant world is a very unstable world. All right. One of the reasons this whole story of the Near Eastern crisis, especially 1877-78 phase of the crisis, is so interesting is that it points to a very different way of looking at that issue. Because this relationship between between Britain and Russia, between the world's premier naval power by far, and a massive land power like Russia, is a defense-dominant relationship if there ever was one. Russia doesn't have to worry about the British fleet attacking Moscow. The expression in those days was the British fleet doesn't run on wheels. Nor does Britain have to worry about the Russian army marching on London. Right? So, according to this theory, you see, this should be a very stable relationship. And in fact, you find exactly the opposite. You found during the period of the Crimean War, now again in 1877, 78, you find Disraeli taking a very cavalier attitude about war toward England, and to a certain extent, the Russians taking a rather cavalier attitude toward the risk of war by, you know, just thumbing their nose at the rest of Europe and imposing this Treaty of San Stefano on the Turks, knowing full well that the other powers don't like this at all. It's only to be understood in terms of Russia sensing who's going to attack them. They're just too big to be attacked. Especially not by Britain with the British fleet. Okay? So you can see there's another logic that comes into play here. Right? In a defense-dominant world, the risks are limited. It's a world of limited liability. Russia doesn't really have to worry all that much about what Britain can do, and the British don't have to worry about what Russia can do. So in a defense-dominant world, you can take a very cavalier attitude toward war because your downside risk is limited. Right? It's important. I mean, and this is a nice example of how looking at the historical record with these theoretical considerations in mind could trigger a thought process, set your mind in motion, leading you to kind of think, well, there's a real conceptual problem here. How does the offense-defense balance, as these people refer to it, how does it affect the stability of international politics? At the very least, the answer is the issue is a whole lot more complex than it might seem at first glance. Right. So those are kind of the conclusions that you would get from looking at the Near Eastern crisis, okay? But the Near Eastern crisis is important for us also because it sets the stage for this fundamental transformation in the nature of international politics that takes place in its aftermath. And this is the beginning of the alliance system, the construction of all of these alliances. You could see what they were. The first big step is the Austro-German alliance, again, right in the aftermath of the Near Eastern crisis, 1879. And then you have a kind of a semi-counterweight to that, which is the Second Dreikaiserbund, League of the Three Emperors of 1881. Then the Triple Alliance with Germany, Austria, and Italy, 1882. Then various alliances in the Balkans, an Austro-Serbian alliance, an Austro-German-Romanian alliance, again in the early 1880s, followed by the alliances at the very end of the Bismarckian period in 1887, alliances and alignments, the Mediterranean agreements, which tied the Germanic powers, Austria and Germany, to Britain. And that was offset by what was called the reinsurance treaty between Germany and Russia. Right? So you have this element of balancing. Why is this whole business of alliances important and stuff? First of all, how does it relate to what we were, this whole Near Eastern crisis? Well, at least ostensibly, the Austro-German alliance was a response to Russia's reaction to the Congress of Berlin and the whole Near Eastern crisis. Russia's in a very bad mood about being, you know, forced to kind of go back on her grandiose ambitions on the tear up the Treaty of San Stefano, accept the verdict of Europe, you know, being dragged before the court of Europe and so on. And I think the Tsar of Russia referred to the whole Congress of Berlin as a European alliance against Russia under the presidency of Prince Bismarck, right, under the leadership of Bismarck. Right? And so this was the context in which the Austro-German alliance was negotiated. See, it's not quite the same as saying it's real cause. It's of interest because of the way it relates to that central structural problem that Germany had to face. You know, remember this Bismarck's geopolitical problem? In a Europe of five great powers, the key thing is to be one of three. Well, that alignment of three could not include France because of Alsace-Lorraine. So effectively, there are only two possible alignments. The alignment with the two other Eastern empires, Austria and Russia, or the alignment, the anti-Russian alignment between Germany, Austria, and Britain, and what can you do? You don't want to kind of opt for one or the other, lest you become the slave of your allies. You want to keep your options open, and you balance between those two possible alignments. That's the essence of the Bismarckian strategy, and the whole question is, how long can it last? Is this a stable solution? It's rather tenuous. What determines its viability is you know, what happens in the world. If these Balkan issues are on the back burner and people don't have to worry about them, well, you can maintain this kind of system. You can maintain good relations with both Austria and Russia. But when whole question of the fate of the Ottoman Empire and the future of Southeastern Europe is at the top of the agenda, you can't do that. You know, the structural problems become very acute. And you can see that this kind of juggling act that you're trying to do, it becomes much, much more difficult. The whole system places a premium on diplomatic skill, on maneuver, in fact, on duplicity, because you have to tell everybody all these different things. You know, you can't be totally honest in this kind of system. But those problems become much more severe when Russia and Austria are really at odds over these kind of over these Balkans. Forces Germany to show her hand. And that's the last thing that Bismarck wants, because if Germany shows her hand, that means, as we'll see, opting for Austria. And the more overt that is, the more Russia is likely to kind of give up on the tie with Germany and go over to the side of France, at which point Germany would be dependent on her allies, on Austria, perhaps on Britain as well. Okay, so that's why this business is important, but it also has a theoretical importance. A theoretical importance is the way it bears on the whole question of alliances. You know, actually, there are two questions about alliances. One is that question that's related to those, you know, like I say, high school type accounts, which is that the alliance system was a big cause of it. The old diplomacy of arms and alliances was a big cause of the war. Basic aspect of the liberal faith of Woodrow Wilson, was the alliance system, in fact, the cause of the war? Well, we'll try and analyze that question. You can't just say, well, you had the alliance system, and then you had the war, and so therefore the alliance system had to be the cause of the war. Because you have other systems in which you have even more rigid alliances, like the NATO versus the Warsaw Pact during the Cold War, and people think that that's a source of stability. You know, it made the status quo very clear, very massive block of power confronting another block of power. You know, it locked everyone in the status quo, right? So you have to do a different kind of analysis. But there's another alliance problem. And this is the problem, it's a kind of conceptual problem. It's based on this notion that countries pursue policies based on their interests. Well, if they pursue policies based on their interests, why should alliances make any difference? Why do you need them? Right? This is an argument that the French would always make about the United States during the Cold War. French would say, the Americans aren't going to doing us any favor. They're not going to defend Western Europe because they've signed the NATO alliance. Right? The NATO alliance and no NATO alliance. The Americans have to defend Western Europe against the Soviets for their own interests, for their own geopolitical reasons. So we don't owe them anything. They're not doing us any favors. You know, their policies are based on their own interests. Alliances don't mean anything. If there were no alliance, they would have to do pretty much the same thing. And if you did have an alliance, and it would no longer serve the interests of the country, then the alliance would be a dead letter. One way or the other, alliances don't mean anything. You know, this is, and it's a serious problem. Why should alliances matter? People assume that they matter, But that notion kind of runs against the basic idea that countries' fundamental policies are shaped by their core geostrategic interests. Alliances or no alliances, why should they make a difference? Okay, so so you have all these kind of theoretical and conceptual questions in your mind when you look at the whole story of what happened in 1879 through 1887, the whole construction of Bismarck's alliance system. Okay? And I was saying before, that first alliance, the alliance between Germany and Austria, is not to be understood simply in terms of Russia's irritation at what had happened in 1878, the Congress of Berlin. Because this is a fundamental shift in German policy, and it's not to be explained by something that obviously transitory. Yeah, countries get irritated, but the irritation passes, and ultimately they pursue policies based on their interests. Right? So it's a shift. You want more structure, a certain element of rigidity. You're moving away from the flexible system, a system based on the free play of international political forces. The system that Bismarck had mastered, he was a master of, from 1862 through the unification of Germany in 1871, and then even through the early mid-1870s. Okay? And now there's a change. And Taylor, I think, is very, very good on this. He calls this the change of course, away from liberal to conservative, away from a system based on the free play of forces to an attempt to introduce some structure into the system. Less freedom, more rigidity. Not necessarily a bad thing. You know, the term rigidity has a negative connotation. You shouldn't think about it in those terms. Taylor notes this corresponds to important domestic changes as well, from Bismarck's alignment with liberals and all kinds of issues. You know, this whole notion of allow the free play of forces to run its course. You know, domestically that means get the state off the back of the economy, allow the economy to just roll along on its own with as few constraints as possible. That's 19th century liberalism. Liberal, it's the same root as liberty, it just means freedom. But now you have this shift in this domestic political shift within Germany. For example, in the whole matter of economic policy, much more dirigiste. Much more an attempt to kind of regulate the free play of forces. So you have in 1879 a dramatic shift in Germany's foreign economic policy away from a liberal approach to a protectionist approach, away from free trade to protectionism. Tariff of 1879 is very important. And I should say also it has a direct effect on Germany's relations with Russia. Now, why is this? Because one of the great dramas of the 19th century is what we call globalization. You have these dramatic changes in transportation technology. You know, the railroads, the shift from wind as being the primary motive force in shipping to coal-fired engines. And what this means is that transportation costs plummet. And it means that the food products, above all the grains of these very remote areas in North America, both the United States and Canada, South America, especially Argentina, the Ukraine, the south of the Russian Empire, now become grain exporters because the grains that they produce can be transported very cheaply to these European markets. Right? In a sense, you may say, well, this is a boon for Europe because they get very cheap food. But there are always people who suffer, namely the indigenous grain producers, who happen in Germany to be a very important class. The Junkers, the landowners in the east of Germany, so the Prussian East. You know, this is the main forest behind the Prussian state, and the officers of the Prussian army are drawn from this class. These people are suffering from all this. Plus, Germany is now really going into the Industrial Revolution in a big way. And the German industrialists have an interest in protection. And so there's this alliance that's made, a conservative alliance between German industry and German agriculture. The alliance of Rhine steel, it was called. And for protectionist policy. Both the new industries and the old agriculture will be protected by this tariff wall. Right? And who suffers? Well, the workers, who now have to pay much higher prices. So this means that Bismarck is shifting away from the liberals and opting for a different sort of strategy in Germany, a strategy of just shoring up the status quo, very similar to his foreign policy. Germany's a satiated power. Germany wants to shore up the status quo. You know, have a strong structure to underpin the status quo. Okay? So you have these domestic political, domestic economic changes going on. All right. Plus, there's another domestic element. You recall how during the period of German unification, 1848 on, there was this great debate among the German nationalists about what form of German state you were going to have. The Kleindeutsch versus the Grossdeutsch. Kleindeutsch meant not including Austria. Grossdeutsch meant including everyone who spoke German, including people in Austria, what's present-day Austrian Republic, but also these areas in which there was a significant German population within the Habsburg monarchy, what's now the Czech Republic, other areas as well. And so conflict was decided by Prussia's military victories in favor of the Kleindeutsch solution. But still, there was this kind of pan-German sentiment Bismarck had to take into account. And a kind of compromise was reached between the old Kleindeutsch and Grossdeutsch traditions. The German state would be a Kleindeutsch state, but there would be very good relations between that state and the Austrian monarchy. Right? You know, this would appeal to the people who had Grossdeutsch sympathies. Right? So you had all these factors coming into play, that conditioned Bismarck's policy. But they were by no means the most important factors. Bismarck thought above all in geopolitical terms. And the alliance with Austria has to be understood in that context. Why did Germany want an alliance with Austria? Because Germany wanted to back the Austrian policy of maintaining the status quo. Not just in Austria itself, but in Austria's neighborhood in southeastern Europe. And why does Bismarck want to do that? Well, what's the alternative? Allowing, if you don't back Austria, then the odds are that Russia is going to prevail over Austria because Russia is a stronger country than Austria. Unless you could throw Germany's weight into the balance to rectify that disequilibrium, Russia would prevail. And what would it mean for Russia to prevail? Russian power would penetrate not just to Russia's south, through Romania, through what's now Bulgaria, down to the Turkish Straits, but Russian power would penetrate even into the Western Balkans, to what's now Serbia and the whole southern Slav region, encouraging the Slavic nationalities within the Habsburg monarchy to secede, to demand their own independence, and then that would be the end of Austria, and then Germany wouldn't have Austria as an ally to serve as a counterweight against Russian power. Germany in the long run might be at the mercy of Russia. So Russian power had to be contained. That's the basic policy choice. We'll see. Everything else kind of follows from that. Russian power had to be contained, because otherwise Germany would be caught in this vice between a hostile France in her west and this enormously powerful Russian state to her east, with no other continental great power ally. Not a very pleasant position. Okay? And so you make that fundamental policy choice. You make this alliance with Austria, 1879. But you don't want to be the slave of Austria. You want to kind of balance that alignment with Austria, which is in essence an anti-Russian alignment, with policies that keep the line open to St. Petersburg, that keep a decent relationship with Russia intact. Because you need Russia as a counterweight to Austria, because otherwise you'll be too dependent on Austria, you limit your own freedom of action. Okay? So you want to have this kind of balance. Again, you know, there are core political decisions, but the whole style of Bismarck's policies places an enormous emphasis on balancing, on maintaining freedom of action, maintaining a degree of power over what happens. And you can do this because you can make the argument to Russia that actually your alignment with Austria is in Russia's interest. Because with Austria dependent on you as Austria's main ally, you would then have a lot of influence over Austria's policy, and that you would use that influence to kind of try and bring about a solution that both sides could live with. And the solution that Bismarck always talked about was a partition of the Balkans into two spheres of influence, where Russia would dominate the east, and Austria would dominate the West, right? You know, partition, so Russia would dominate what's now Romania, Bulgaria, and Austria would dominate the whole southern Slav area, and Serbia, and so on, down to kind of northern Greece. So that's the line that Bismarck took with Russia. I want you to see that it's not a totally honest line, because the core of the policy is keeping Russia out of the Balkans in its entirety, but he's basically pretending that he's sympathetic with Russian aspirations in the Eastern Balkans, and he's looking for this kind of partition. And duplicity of that sort is built into the very heart of Bismarck's policy. Is it necessarily a bad thing? Do you want to, you know, condemn it? Well, you have to think of what the alternatives would be, what a straightforward policy would be. And we'll actually see what a straightforward policy ended up being after Bismarck's fall in 1890. Okay. What's the evidence to indicate that Bismarck wanted to kind of keep Russia out of it? Well, he certainly, you know, the Germanic powers, especially, you know, pursued a policy of dominating the Western Balkans. You had this, political agreement worked out between Austria and Serbia in 1881, I think. Yeah, and then, but the really important thing is the alliance with Romania, the alliance between Austria, Germany, and Romania that was signed in 1883. Why is this important? This is the Eastern Balkans. Why is it important? If Russian power is to penetrate down toward Constantinople and even into the Eastern Balkans, Bulgaria and so on, Russia has to penetrate through Romania. You know, just look at the map. Russian troops have to be able to march through Romania, pretty much. Because if it was just a naval thing, the British could come to the aid of the Turks. And for Bismarck, in his own term, Romania was to be, quote, an iron barrier across the path of expansion of Russia to the Balkans. Right? If you're basically saying, once the Russians get through, once they dominate the east, eastern Balkans, there's going to be no way of preventing them from dominating all the Balkans, because Pan-Slavic sympathies in Russia and geopolitical interest in Russia is going to have its own momentum. The only way to kind of stem the Russian tide is like the little boy who sticks his thumb in the hole in the dike, is to keep the Russians from dominating Romania, right? And this, the Russians, this policy the Romanians are willing to cooperate with. Not that they have any love for Austria, because there are an awful lot of Romanians who are still in the Habsburg monarchy in the western part of present-day Romania, what's called Transylvania. But they are especially angry with Russia at this point, because Romania had been Russia's ally in the war against Turkey in 1877. And at the end of the war, Russia showed her gratitude toward Romania by taking a very important area from Romania called Bessarabia. It's an area of mixed Romanian and Slavic nationalities. All right. So the Romanians, also sensing how strong the Germanic powers are, gravitate to their side. This is what's going to, guarantee Romanian security. They can't trust their security to Russia. And people could see which way the wind is blowing. That Bismarck now holds all the strings. Germany is the number one power in Europe, and second tier powers gravitate to the German side. That's the meaning of the Triple Alliance in 1881. Excuse me, 1882. The agreement between Germany, Austria, and Italy, precipitated by the French move into Tunis, which Bismarck had actually encouraged the French to do, which the Italians had viewed as an eventual area for Italian expansion. So you have Italy, which is a second-tier power, gravitating to the German side. All right, so what else do we have? All this stuff, I'll be talking about this next time, is completed toward the end of the decade by, in another Near Eastern crisis, by the Mediterranean agreements, which are an alignment between the Germanic powers and Britain, not a formal alliance. And the counterweight to that is the reinsurance treaty, as it's called, which is a kind of a political agreement between Germany and Russia. So once again, you have one hand reaches to Britain in the west, the other hand reaches to Russia in the east, and Bismarck wants to balance between these two sets of agreements. Okay. What's important about all this stuff? This is a set of arrangements that Bismarck has worked out to try and stabilize the status quo. What's important is not so much the alliances as formal legal documents as the policies that they symbolize. A policy of trying to stabilize the status quo, consolidate the status quo, shore up the status quo. If that's your goal, then the particular strategy that's used is probably the optimal strategy. The strategy not of opting for one alignment as opposed to another, but trying to keep your options open. Because by doing that, you increase your own freedom of action. You avoid being too dependent on any of your allies. The fewer allies you have, the more any of them could threaten to go over to the side of your adversaries. And that threat could drag you into a conflict that you would prefer not to fight. So if you want to maintain the status quo, this is probably the best solution. And as I say, a certain element of duplicity, of talking out of both sides of your mouth, is built into that kind of strategy of maximizing flexibility. One last point is that the only sort of policy that's conceivable? Well, you could imagine a much more radical policy on Germany's part. Let Austria fall apart. When Austria falls apart, the German-speaking parts of Austria would gravitate and be integrated into the German Empire. France could be compensated for that by allowing them to have Alsace-Lorraine back. That would pave the way to a reconciliation between France and Germany, because France would have an interest in a relatively strong Germany as its counterweight to this Russian colossus, you know, and so on and so on. You can make an argument that those kind of alternatives might have been better. But countries cannot think in those radical terms. You know, they think in terms of the existing system. And certainly Bismarck was thinking not in radical terms but anymore, although he did in 1860. He was thinking now in terms of how do you go about shoring up the system, and the sort of system that evolved, Bismarck's alliance system in the course of the 1880s, was the best answer he could come up with. Now, I'll talk more about this stuff next time when we deal with the late 1880s.